This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated June 20th, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article, Banking on a Legacy. For years, Mechanics and Farmers Bank served as a cornerstone of Durham's Paris Street commercial and financial district. Today, the bank strives to keep its community-focused mission in the face of economic and regulatory burdens. By Lauren K. Onisorge. James Sanson remembers the vault's mystery when he was a kid, watching with curiosity as people went in and out. The contents of their safety deposit boxes a secret. The Mechanics and Farmers Bank vault is still what Samson sees when he pictures that old building in downtown Durham, at the heart of what used to be known as the Black Wall Street, the financial center for the African-American community during the Jim Crow days. Samson, just this year, sliding into the CEO shoes worn by Father Joe Samson years ago, has always known that the bank, started by his great-grandfathers, is his legacy. It's been in his family for more than 100 years, although the headquarters has moved outside the downtown perimeter it once shared with a sister institution, North Carolina Mutual Life, which still owns more than 9% of Mechanics and Farmers. Growing up, we knew we had to work at the bank, he laughs. We didn't have a choice. It was both dinner table conversation and destiny, not just for Samson, but for his close-knit community. The three largest shareholders are longtime members of that community, Centurion Selena Wheeler, Vivian Samson, James Samson's mother, and Julia Taylor. Samson says everyone in his family worked at the bank at one time or another. But for the bank to be around for more than 100 years, it will have had to reach outside the tradition that's kept its Durham faithful opening account since 1908. And lurking in the shadows is the $11.7 million the bank still owes the feds from the Troubled Asset Relief Program. The bank ended 2013 with about $300 million in total assets, a $179 million loan portfolio, and net income of $400,000. The profitable numbers, the family and execs agree, are partially due to the bank's conservative history. Samson's cousin, Chuck Watts, attorney at the bank's law firm and a North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance veteran, says conservationism has been a consistent attitude at M&F. All the black financial institutions in Durham, conservation is part of their DNA, he says. That begins to be a challenge when you start to talk about growth. But the ones we know about survived. They survived the Great Depression and the recession, so it's really a credit to the leaders. The bank represents a tradition of shared financial literacy where a father brings his son into the bank to start his first savings account, a culture the son, decades later, continues with his own family. That, along with a history of necessity. Black people could not go to white banks to do business, says Reggie Jones, Paris Project spearhead and senior economic development coordinator for the city of Durham. Eileen Welch, a biographer and Watts' sister, who remembers watching her grandfather in an immaculate suit go to work every day at North Carolina Mutual Life, saw the house she grew up in torn down for a low-income housing development on Fayetteville Street. Moore's house, the literal center of her family's story, was destroyed when the expressway was built. They were beautiful homes, she said, adding pointedly that the powers that be did manage to salvage areas important to white cultural history, such as Trinity Park and Duke Heritage Forest. A lot of towns in the county, when they decided to do urban renewal, and we called it urban removal, because they tried to destroy our history. M&F and North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance are two of the strongest symbols of that history that remain. They are more than financial institutions, she says, pointing out that the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance cafeteria was, during the Jim Crow era, the only restaurant option available to African Americans in downtown Durham. M&F was certainly one of the only avenues for funding as African Americans began their businesses and bought their houses. Historian and Duke University professor Barbara Lau says M&F played a key role in Durham's downtown. Access to capital is such an important part of being able to be an entrepreneur, being able to be a business person, being able to be a homeowner at a time when most white banks were very hesitant to make those kinds of loans, he says. Welch says that's why her great-grandfathers founded the bank. Aaron Moore and John Merrick, her mother's grandfathers on both sides, were friends at the turn of the century. Moore was the first African-American doctor in Durham and saw the need for insurance as widows struggled without a breadwinner. He teamed up with Merrick, a barbershop owner and former slave, to start the life insurance company. They, along with R.B. Fitzgerald, the bank's original head, and J.A. Dodson, J.R. Hawkins, W.G. Pearson, James Shepard, G.W. Stevens, and Sanford Warren, also began M&F Bank. The great-grandfather's names are also on the charter for North Carolina Central University. These guys were entrepreneurs, businessmen who understood how to help the masses, Welch says. And they were dedicated, even paying the first claim for North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance out of their own pockets, she says. Visionary African-American leaders in Durham came together to found these institutions that helped families here who were on the black side of town be able to borrow money, deposit money, and do all the things that banks do for families, Welch says. But desegregation brought competition, Lau reports. All of these businesses that relied on a very targeted market that for many years didn't have access to the entire marketplace, they're going to be challenged when the marketplace opens up, Lau says. To the close-knit community surrounding the institutions, however, it's not just the bank that threatens by a changing world. It's the preservation of an important part of their history, and they've been fighting for their legacy for decades. Watts says that when the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Building was constructed, there was controversy about an African-American-owned building rising so prominently into the sky. It's been important to this community for decades, Welch says of M&F. The hope is the bank will be important for decades to come, reminding Durham and North Carolina of the Black Wall Street that once was. But to maintain the legacy, we'll have to survive the next decade, a period that will see interest rate challenges and unmatched competition. That's where Kim Saunders, former M&F CEO and current CEO of M&F's parent company, M&F Bank Corp, comes in. Her job is to transition the bank into the 21st century, and she's done it before. Prior to M&F, she led Consolidated Bank and Trust in Richmond, the successor organization of the first U.S. bank founded by an African-American woman, Maggie Lena Walker. That bank had fallen into significant trouble, she says. It was on the brink of closure. It had been losing a lot of money. After joining in 2000, Saunders helped right the historic ship, restoring profitability. M&F headhunted her, hiring her as its second female CEO in 2008. You certainly realize the responsibility when you sit in the CEO seat, she says, but it's a different story than Richmond's. The bank has never, ever lost any money, so the bank has been profitable since it opened for business in August of 1908. With Sansom taking over the operational helm in March, Sanders can focus on M&F's digital makeover, the bank's big push to grab new customers. During her tenure, she added mobile banking, the first step, she says, in connecting with a new kind of client, the kind whose parents didn't open their savings accounts here when they were 16 years old. Saunders is also tasked with developing a payback plan for TARP, the federal dollars credited to the bank that currently have a 2% interest rate. In 2018, however, that rate more than quadruples to 9%. But Saunders isn't worried about the $11.7 million the bank still has to pay back. Even in today's market, the 9% requirement is still relatively cheap for equity, she says. Tony Plath, UNC Charlotte economist, says it's extremely expensive, however, and not tax-deductible. That's why so many banks are consolidating. That and the fact that the private equity dollars to pay it back are scarce. He anticipates M&F working out a payback deal. The government is being somewhat understanding of these community banks that have TARP outstanding, he says, pointing to the Bank of the Carolinas, a Davie County-based institution that was able to buy back $13 million shares for $3 million, a terrific haircut. The big problem, Plath says, isn't the TARP cost. It's that they need the capital, he says. What do you replace it with? If they pay it back, they have to replace it with more money. Not all banks can do that. And federal payback is only part of the challenge. Once interest rates start to rise, margins are going to be compressed for our industry, so it's essential to look for other ways to generate income in terms of fees and other lines of business, says Saunders. As an institution that serves minority and low-income residents, there's also more flexibility over what M&F can do with cash, she points out. Plath says that focused clientele is its biggest strength. They locate their branches and marketing efforts in places where there's a high concentration of African Americans, he says. They serve that community and serve it well. Saunders also hopes the frustration people have with big banks, those with global presences such as Bank of America and BB&T, will work to M&F's benefit. Thad Woodard, president and CEO of the North Carolina Bankers Association, says she's right to play up M&F's face-to-face contact. No matter how far we may advance towards becoming robots of the future, everyone always loves to hear their name called, she says. But personal touch alone won't be enough to keep M&F alive through the next 100 years. Saunders says it takes strategy. We're excited about the future, she says. So far, M&F has resisted a big community banking trend, consolidation. While the bank did purchase Mutual Community Savings in 2008, it hasn't gone through the acquisitions and name changes of many of its peers. Saunders doesn't rule out future consolidation, but says keeping M&F's traditional identity isn't so much of a goal as a responsibility. We're part of Durham's history, she says. Harry Davis, professor of banking and finance at Appalachian State University, says rising regulatory costs make independence a tough sell. Regulatory costs have risen and will continue to rise, and those costs need to be spread out over a larger asset base, he says, blaming Dodd-Frank for a string of consolidations in the past year. 2% of U.S. banks are lost each year due to consolidation made in order to keep up with regulatory costs and the cost of new competitive services, such as wealth management and mobile banking, says Davis. But consolidation comes at a cost. Often it's the name and identity a bank has held on to for decades. Jim Beck, CEO of Trust Atlantic Bank and longtime bank executive, echoes that it's rare to find such an unchanged, surviving institution of any kind. It takes a lot of great things coming together over a long period of time to be able to pull that off, he says. And he recognizes the pressure M&F execs feel in maintaining both a presence and a legacy. It's a pretty impressive story, the Black Wall Street, he says. That, I think, is something we ought to make sure we don't lose sight of. But the next generation of mechanics and Farmers Bank may look very different. Samson has one young son who currently has no interest in banking. For the first time, he sees a future without a relative at the helm, and no Samson in line of succession. I don't know what will happen, he says. What follows is a timeline for a history of Mechanics and Farmers Bank on Durham's Parish Street. 1899, North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance opens for business in Durham. The first month's collections amount to $1.12. 1906, North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company moves its headquarters to Parish Street. 1907, bank is organized by R.B. Fitzgerald, J.A. Dodson, J.R. Hawkins, John Merrick, Aaron Moore, W.G. Pearson, James E. Shepard, G.W. Stevens, and Sanford Warren. Warren, grandfather of Julia Taylor, is an early president. Moore and Merrick are great-grandfathers of current CEO James Samson. 1908. Mechanics and Farmers opens for business at 112 West Parish Street. 1910. Booker T. Washington visits. 1921. Mechanics and Farmers merges with Fraternal Bank and Trust. 1923. M&F expands to Raleigh. 1935. M&F becomes the first lending institution in North Carolina to receive a certificate of authority from the Federal Housing Administration. Assets exceed $1 million. 1965, M&F purchases 116 West Paris Street headquarters. 1999, M&F purchases new headquarters building at 2634 Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard. 1999, Mechanics and Farmers shareholders approve the creation of its holding company, M&F Bank Corp. 2003, M&F breaks $200 million in assets. 2007, Kim Saunders takes over as CEO of Mechanics and Farmers. 2008, M&F acquires Mutual Community Savings. 2009, M&F sells 11.7 million dollars worth of stock to the U.S. Department of Treasury through the Capital Purchase Program of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, also known as TARP. 2010, M&F exchanges its stock under another program in order to pay a lower interest rate. 2014, Kim Saunders steps down as CEO, transitions to CEO of the parent company. James Sampson takes over as CEO. Next up, Small Business Profile, the Godwin Group. A familiar sight on U.S. highways, how a Dunn manufacturer plays a big role in the national truck market. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. The welding spatter lights up the cavernous warehouse where dozens of Godwin manufacturing workers assemble dump truck beds or snowplows and salt spreaders headed to the cities in colder climates. On a tour of the plant, Godwin Group President Pat Godwin Jr., son of the company's founder, Pat Godwin Sr., explains that their plant in Dunn, a town about 40 miles south of Raleigh, has the capacity to make 100 dump beds a week. The company has been the go-to provider for dump trucks to North Carolina Department of Transportation for about 40 years, and regularly contracts with other states and municipal transportation departments across the country. If you see a state DOT truck with a yellow cab and black bed, it will be a Godwin product, he says, estimating North Carolina Department of Transportation buys about 150 dump trucks per year. For most of Godwin's other customers, check the mud flaps or the Godwin name stenciled on the back of the bed. There aren't many frills at the Godwin plants in Dunn, which are spread across 400,000 square feet of buildings protected by a chain-link fence along U.S. Highway 421, just off I-95 in Harnett County. But this is not a frilly business. Pat Godwin Sr., now 72, started the company in 1966 after he quit his steady paycheck job as a route salesman for Pepsi so he could open his own welding repair shop. His first flatbed truck project was for his uncle, a farmer in rural Sampson County. The company has since grown to become the largest family-owned dump bed manufacturing company in the country, according to industry sources. Godwin won't disclose the company's annual revenues, but sources estimate it ranges between $60 million and $100 million per year, depending on the cycles of the industry. Godwin does hint that the company's Champion Hoist and Equipment Company subsidiary on the other side of town, about 4 miles away, has grown more than 300% in the past 3 years, primarily because it now sells also to Godwin's competitors. That's about when Pat Godwin had decided to take the hoist equipment and technology that had been developed by his engineers and from the two of the other companies Godwin had acquired in Kentucky and Ohio in the early 2000s and combined their resources into one facility. They called the new company Champion Hoist and Equipment Company, since it would be consolidating into the former Champion Athletic Wear sewing operation plant in Dunn, which had been shuttered for several years after Champion moved the operations to Mexico. We had bought that property purely as an investment in the late 90s, and it just sat there for several years not being used, said Pat Godwin Jr. Then when we decided to spin off this unit, there was an aha moment and a light bulb went off. Now we know what to do with this building. Nationally, the Godwin Group employs about 400 people, and about 180 of those employees are based at its two plants in Harnett County. Godwin also has manufacturing sites in Ohio, Kentucky, and most recently added a third site in Salt Lake City, Utah, with the acquisition of Williamson Manufacturing. Godwin's largest competitor is TBEI of Minnesota, a conglomeration of five manufacturers of dump bodies, hoists, and trailer equipment. A 2012 market research study by Research and Markets estimates that TBEI and the Godwin Group comprise about 38% of the all dump truck body production in North America. Next up is a column in the workplace. This column is by Mr. Edward Marshall. And this week's column is entitled, How Small Companies Can Ensure Successful Change. Change is a constant. It may be the installation of an ERP system or a disruptive technology that has just been introduced that undermines the value of products. Or there is new competition from a cheaper provider overseas. People want certainty, so we resist change and avoid taking risks. The old adage is that the pain of not changing has to be greater than the pain of changing, that there has to be a burning platform. Even if that platform does not exist, leadership may be unwilling to change. Imagine a business that was going to shut down unless there was a fundamental shift in their culture, and they chose not to. Within a year, the business is gone. But let's say there is a commitment to launch a change initiative. We know from research conducted by Harvard that the failure rate for change initiatives is as high as 75%. The cost of a failed change can be staggering, impacting morale, quality, and profitability. These efforts fail in large part because the workforce doesn't have a stake in the initiative and/or there is a lack of sustained leadership support. To increase the prospect for a successful change initiative, workforce ownership of the change process is critical. Simply telling them what will happen to them does not guarantee buy-in. It usually ends up as the opposite, resistance and resentment. To build ownership, there should be a strategy that engages a workforce and gives them a stake in success. They will have to implement it and most likely can tell you the best way to improve the business. At Marriott International, the backroom operations of full-service hotels needs to be automated. There were 1,800 people across the country who produced guest invoices overnight. 75% of them were going to lose their jobs as a result of the change. You could expect significant resistance. A collaborative change process engaged 100% of them in defining the current state, making recommendations, and then reviewing the new design. The new design was implemented, giving Marriott guests their bills under the door. 97% of the workforce participated. 85% approved of the process. The most often heard comment was, "Thank you for listening." The company supported everyone who lost their jobs either with new positions, retraining, or transition packages. These employees wanted to contribute their input to be heard. They had a stake in the company serving customers better. Ownership is a powerful principle for implementing any major change. It's a no-lose proposition. Leadership gets invaluable information about their business and virtually no resistance. The workforce gets to be heard, to contribute, and to guide the direction of the change. Having them fully vested in the change process through an ownership strategy is a way to ensure the success of the change. Next up is Amanda Hoyle's column. Amanda covers commercial and residential real estate. Her first article is entitled, New Construction to Test Triangle Apartment Market. The construction crews of the Sky House apartment tower in downtown Raleigh ceremonially topped out the 23rd floor of the building on June 20th, a milestone marking the halfway point of construction for a building that will add heft to the Raleigh skyline. Sky House will add another 320 luxury-style apartment units to a triangle market that is already becoming saturated with new multifamily units. The vacancy rate for the triangle apartment market increased to 7.6% in March from a vacancy rate of 5.6% in September, according to the semi-annual Triangle Apartment Market Report by the Carnes Research Firm and Triangle Apartment Association. The region's apartment vacancy is projected to increase even more over the next 12 months when another 6,600 new apartment units are scheduled to open. But that hasn't slowed developers and investors in moving forward with even more apartment plans in downtown Raleigh and elsewhere throughout the Triangle. Greg Sandrouter of Beacon Partners confirmed on June 16th that his firm has secured both its equity and debt financing needed to begin construction of his Edison Apartments project adjacent to Sky House Raleigh. Beacon's partner in the six-story Edison apartment building is the NRP Group of Cleveland, Ohio. "I think that these buildings are really going to be complementary," Sandrouter says. "Our goal is to offer something for everybody." Sky House is expected to start moving in its first residents in early January 2015, and Edison Apartments is scheduled for a completion in December 2015. Downtown Raleigh Alliance President and CEO David Diaz estimates that 1,200 new residential units will be added to downtown Raleigh within the next 3 to 5 years. And coming soon, Link Apartments coming to Glenwood South in 2015. Investors and stakeholders from Grub Properties and the Calicow Group gathered at 42nd Street Oyster Bar on June 17th to mark the official groundbreaking for the 204-unit Link Apartments Glenwood South apartment project. Link is located at the corner of West Street and Jones Street, one block east of Glenwood Avenue, and is expected to open in summer 2015. And currently on tap, the Lincoln Apartments to open in the summer of 2015. Chicago real estate financier John Nikolic's $40 million bet on downtown Raleigh has taken a forward leap. The high-end apartment known as the Lincoln has officially broken ground. Nikolic, whose Chicago area apartment management and investment firm Banner Apartments is providing most of the $40 million behind the project, says via prepared statement that the structure will be part of the evolution of downtown Raleigh. The Lincoln is a massive urban apartment complex on track to be open next summer. It is located one block east of Moore Square Park and takes up the full city block bordered by Harget, Martin, Bloodworth, and East Streets. It's a building that used to be owned by a Raleigh businessman and philanthropist, Gordon Smith III. The two-acre city block was sold to a buyer group comprised of Raleigh investors John Florian of the Florian Companies and John Healy of Hyde Street Holdings, along with Banner Apartments in 2013 for $4.34 million. Florian and Healy are investing through a joint venture called KeyBank Real Estate Capital. This week's By the Numbers is the Triangle apartment vacancy rate. The vacancy rate in March 2013 was 5.5%. September 2013 was 5.6%. In March 2014, it was 7.6%, and the Triangle apartment vacancy rate as of September 2014 projected is 9 to 10%. The average monthly rental rate in September 2012 was $873. And the average monthly rental rate in March 2013 was $879. Average monthly rental rate in September 2013 is $898, and $913 was the average monthly rental rate in March of 2014. This week's column covering healthcare and biopharmaceuticals is by Jason DeBruin, and his first column is entitled Research: Sales Pitches Play Role in Prescriptions. Drug sales forces continue to promote off-label uses to doctors, effectively leading some physicians to prescribe medicines not based on medical evidence, but on a salesperson's push. Pharmaceutical companies are strictly prohibited from publicly marketing their drugs for any uses other than what is on their labels, uses that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has allowed. However, many drugs can be used as treatment for other diseases, and physicians can make what are called off-label prescriptions. New research published in the academic medical journal Health Affairs, however, shows that some drug companies effectively encourage physicians to prescribe their drugs off-label through a process called detailing, or promoting drugs directly to physicians by pharmaceutical salespeople. Pharmaceutical industry marketing has been shown to affect physician prescribing in favor of the promoted product, even if that use is not supported by the totality of the evidence, according to the Health Affairs article, authored by a group that includes two Harvard Medical School professors. Improperly marketing drugs can result in major fines. GlaxoSmithKline, which has North American headquarters in Research Triangle Park, recently reached a $105 million settlement arising from allegations that it improperly marketed drugs including Advair, which is manufactured in Zebulon. Although this settlement applies to GSK, it is far from the only drug maker to face fines or settlements. The authors note that simply prescribing a medicine for off-label use is not bad in and of itself. After all, off-label prescribing can be based on solid data, they write. However, it carries the risk that patients will be exposed to uncertain benefits and the prospect of serious adverse effects. The authors don't recommend to completely abandon off-label prescribing or even to do away with detailing policies, but encourage hospital systems as well as patients to be mindful about drugs that are prescribed for off-label uses. This column's He Said It is by Dr. David J. Drutz, and he is quoted as saying, "This second orphan drug designation underscores the value of this asset and strengthens Dara's resolve and positioning in the ongoing pursuit of partnering opportunities to assist in funding the clinical advancement and development pathway of KRN-5500. Mr. Drutz is the Chief Medical Officer at Dara Biosciences, an oncology supportive care specialty pharmaceutical company. Dara announced on June 16th that it received a second orphan drug designation from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration on drug candidate for the treatment of multiple myeloma." Continuing Jason DeBrun's column of Healthcare and Biopharmaceuticals, it's bond ratings time. Fitch Ratings reviewed the bond grades for two Raleigh hospitals, giving both solid scores on their debt. In order to raise money for large capital projects, area hospitals sell bonds on the public market and receive good grades to help them because they can command lower interest rates, potentially saving millions. Fitch affirmed the rating of AA-, but revised the outlook to negative from stable on the $425 million in bonds sold since 2009. The outlook was downgraded because of operating losses in the past 18 months. During that time, WakeMed has posted operating losses of $14.4 million, or an operating margin of negative 1.4%. WakeMed has recently undertaken some major capital projects, including $82 million to implement the health records system Epic, and $90 million for the WakeMed North Hospital, which will focus primarily on women's health. Fitch believes that all of these are strategically important and will yield economic benefits in the years to come, reports the agency. And as of March 31st, WakeMed had $531 million in unrestricted cash and investments, which equals to 207 days cash on hand, a comfortable cushion. Over the next 2 years, WakeMed needs to continue on its trajectory toward a positive operating margin, Fitch analyst reported. Fitch notes positively that the operating losses have narrowed year over year and volumes year to date have stabilized. Fitch expects 2015 to be a stronger year as the benefits from the strategic investments begin to be realized. A return to 2013 operating losses would lead to a downgrade. And listed is a quick snapshot of the bond report card for WakeMed Health and Hospitals and Healthcare. For Fitch, the AA ratings designates very high quality and one rung below the highest possible AAA rating. The minus symbol associated with the AA minus is adjust for a relative status within the rating. Fitch upgraded the Rex Healthcare rating AA negative from a plus on its $110 million in debt. Fitch rating agents determined Rex, a subsidiary of UNC Healthcare, had another year of solid financial performance in 2013, which it cited as the main reason for the ratings upgrade. Rex borrowed $123 million in 2010 to refinance some bonds and for capital projects, including a new central energy plant at the main campus of Lake Boone Trail. The higher rating could prove valuable for Rex as it plans to spend as much as $440 million in capital projects in the next 4 years, primarily on the new North Carolina Heart and Vascular Hospital at its main campus and the new Holly Springs Hospital. Executives have already begun reaching out for community support and raising funds for those projects, but the hospital system will likely have to go back to the capital markets to finance a significant portion of the costs. As March 31st, the hospital's profitability metrics were slightly lower than historical as the organization recorded income from operations of $19.8 million for a 3.6% operating margin. REC Chief Financial Officer Bernadette Spong reported that the lower profitability in 2014 is primarily related to the large Epic EHR expense and associated implementation, according to Fitch. She expects to return to a 4% operating margin in fiscal 2015. What follows next is Dawn Curry's column, and Dawn covers small business, personalities, and triangle trends. Her first article this week is on small business wanted food corridor in Raleigh. Foundation hopes to boost local farm growth. Two groups hope a downtown Raleigh district can become a food corridor and want your input. The Jamie Kirk Hahn Foundation held a walking tour on June 14th that will allow people to collaborate on where community gardens, urban farms, or pop-up markets could be established to create a food corridor. The foundation was launched in October in memory of political strategist Jamie Kirk Hahn of Raleigh, who was well known for her charitable outreach in the community. Community Food Lab, a Raleigh-based urban food systems engagement design team, is spearheading the overall project concept. It's been involved since the middle of 2013 and is working with other organizations to create a 2-mile corridor in downtown Raleigh, connecting you to U.S. Department of Agriculture designated food deserts along what Community Food Lab is calling the Blunt Person Corridor. According to the USDA, food deserts are defined as urban neighborhoods and rural towns without ready access to fresh, healthy, and affordable food. Instead of supermarkets and grocery stores, these communities may have no food access or are served only by fast food restaurants and convenience stores that offer few healthy, affordable food options. Built from the ground up by food projects throughout the food system, the corridor offers the benefit of local food to all the communities it connects, according to the Community Food Lab website. The corridor can be imagined as a city civic engagement project, a food justice initiative, and a catalyst for the local and regional food systems. There will be a series of collaborative events called Second Saturday in which different locations and activities will address the urban food system idea, such as Grocers on Wheels and Raleigh Raw. There's a Facebook page where people can join and RSVP to the events. Dawn Curry gives us a city snapshot, how Raleigh stacks up to rival Austin. Raleigh is often compared to Austin, Texas, among other mid-sized cities in the United States that we share business and demographics with. A recent side-by-side comparison by Find the Best blog shows why we sometimes lose business to Austin or rank closely on the best of lists. Here are five ways in which Raleigh and Austin compare. Population. Raleigh has nearly half the population of Austin, with 414,373 people in Raleigh compared to Austin's 818,236. Raleigh has a larger female population of 51.9% than Austin at 49.4%. Getting to work. Raleigh's average commute time is shorter than Austin's, with Raleigh's workforce reaching the office in 23.1 minutes on average, compared to Austin's average commute of 24.3 minutes. And both cities have a disproportionately large percentage of young professionals, ages 25 to 34. Raleigh's median age is 32 and Austin's median age is 31.1. Raleigh has more English speakers, 82.2%, than Austin at 67.4%. Obviously, Austin has more Spanish speakers at 25.3% and Raleigh at 9.7%. And Raleigh and Austin are neck and neck with small families dominating the family size scale at 66.4%. Raleigh has more medium-sized families than Austin, and Austin has more large families than Raleigh. Go figure. Next up, Lauren Onisorge's column covering technology and entrepreneurship. Her first column is entitled Wyden's Next Venture Takes Off. The entrepreneurship community knows him first as HQ Raleigh's biggest mover and shaker. Wyden, one of the co-founders of the entrepreneurial co-working space that led the Warehouse District facility from concept to what it is now, a fully filled space with a lengthy waiting list of interested entrepreneurs. It's fulfilled everything we thought it would, he says. Now our problem is trying to accommodate the people who are interested in being a part of it that we don't have space for. Another guy might rest on these laurels, kick his feet back on one of the desks, and bask for a minute. But Don Wyden, who also oversees the residential entrepreneurship program ThinkHouse, serves as Chief Operating Officer of Entrepreneurship Organization Forward Impact, and routinely lobbies for Raleigh startups with the city. Even with all these activities already filling up his calendar, Wyden apparently didn't have enough to do, so he's adding to the workload exponentially and creating a startup of his own. Dubbed RevGen, his brand new company already has 11 employees, and he's expecting to be at 20 by September. Basically, it's a sales and marketing company, he tells me. The idea is that we give people who are entering the workplace or people who are looking to transition into a new career in tech sales, we give them an opportunity to train. They do leads for major technology companies in the region. He's starting with Citrix, the firm that recently bought ShareFile, a company founded by another HQ Raleigh co-founder, Jesse Lipson. They'll hopefully gain some experience, and if they do well, we'll hopefully place them in bigger companies like Citrix, he says. He expects 3 to 6 month turnaround for the new sales associates. Wyden has bootstrapped the firm and expects to keep doing so, but he's not going at it alone. He's tapped former professional soccer player John Lewis as his director of sales. A lot of people we're hiring are recent college graduates that are looking for experience and some good tools, he says. The reason why I selected John is he really understands training. He really understands the team dynamic. The first class of trainees started this month, but Wyden doesn't really have a lot of time to sit around and contemplate where his company is going. After all, he's got salespeople to train and entrepreneurship efforts to run. Also in Lauren's column, the cell phone driving ban has been zapped. The North Carolina Supreme Court struck down a law that would have banned driving while using cell phones in Chapel Hill. Pointing to an understanding that traffic regulation is a state function, the Supreme Court ruled that the town doesn't have the authority to enact the measure. That was a relief to business owners who tell us they depend on using their cell phones on their commutes. Businessmen such as Frank Coker, owner of Elderly Care Service Senior Helpers, which employs more than 50 people in the Triangle. The Durham firm does a lot of business in Chapel Hill, and Coker's been waiting on a decision for more than 2 years. This gives us the freedom to do the work we need to do, he says. We are responsible. We don't text while we drive, but we're often driving to clients. Another Durham business owner, Dave Cotton of six-person cleaning service Advanta Clean, says he told the town all along that the ban wouldn't fly. It was a way for Chapel Hill to stay in the news, he says. Everything happens on my phone, adding that he's not willing to sacrifice his business for what he calls an illegal ordinance. Had the ban been upheld, he says he would have just had to pay the $25 fine. This week's column under Lauren Onisor's Technology and Entrepreneurship, they said it, quote, we're starting a focus in engineering and analytics, and that's one of the things KPIT liked, end quote. That was from Don Thompson, CEO of Raleigh-based iCubed, on the acquisition of the bulk of his firm by Indian IT consulting firm KPIT. Quote, the idea is that if there's a process, such as Kickstarter, and a project has been vetted and there's community support, could we create a program that would provide these funds? End quote. James Sauls, economic director for Raleigh, talking about an idea for the city to match a startup's crowdfunding total as an incentive. And finally, quote, we said, hey, now's the time to live where we want to live, end quote. Michael Deering, the new CEO of wearable technology firm Valencell, on why he moved back to Raleigh. And now it's time for a better world. People and organizations in the news of philanthropy. This column is written by Todd Cohen, and his lead article is Thrift Shop Pursues Collaboration. Since it was created in 1952 to help generate funds for arts education in the Chapel Hill's Carrboro City Schools, the PTA Thrift Shop has raised and donated an estimated $7 million to $8 million to local schools. Now, after opening a new 14,000-square-foot flagship store in December 2013 and a 22,000-square-foot facility it built on 125 West Main Street in Carrboro to replace a smaller building built in the 1940s as a grocery store, the PTA Thrift Shop has leased part of the new facility to three programs of the city schools, generating about $120,000 per year in rent. It also plans to create a nonprofit collaborative venture on the same site, either by renovating and expanding two existing mill houses for a total of 3,500 square feet, or raising them and building a new 5,600 square foot facility that would house 5 to 7 nonprofit tenants. Our plan is to solicit nonprofits that have aligned missions, says Barbara Jesse Black, executive director. By providing the physical and philosophical space for them to work together, she says, the PTA Thrift Shop hopes the nonprofit tenants will be able to have a greater impact on the community. With an annual budget of just over $2 million and a staff of 35 employees, the PTA Thrift Shop also operates a 6,800 square foot retail store at Village Plaza in Chapel Hill. It collects donated items, including art, books, clothing, computers, computer accessories, electronics, furniture, household items, movies, music, and video games, and sells usable items, generating about $200,000 to $300,000 per year that it then donates to the schools through a 20 local parent-teacher associations. Those donated dollars are used to subsidize school playgrounds, science supplies, computer hardware and software, cultural enrichment programs, field trips, sports equipment and uniforms, among other needs. Half the donated items the PTA Thrift Shop receives are not suitable for sale at its retail stores. It either finds another purpose for 80% of those items, recycles them, or sells them to a third party and discards the remaining 20% as trash. Annually, we keep 300 to 500 tons out of the landfill, says Jesse Black. To finance its $4 million new flagship store, the PTA Thrift Shop has raised nearly $500,000 in the first phase of a capital campaign that still aims to raise another $500,000 and used its 1.25-acre site in Carrboro as collateral for a loan. To help diversify its funding, the Thrift Shop has leased the remaining space in its new building to volunteer Head Start and pre-kindergarten programs of the Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools. Funding from the campaign's second phase to begin this fall will support the new nonprofit collaborative venture, which will provide nonprofit tenants with shared space and amenities such as a conference room and breakout room. Our goal, Jesse Black says, is to have a mix of nonprofit partners that embody the values of investing for community good. Also this week, under the nonprofit news, fresh produce for summer campers. Produce Box will donate $28,000 worth of fresh local produce to children who participate in the YMCA of the Triangle subsidized summer day camps in Raleigh. The Produce Box collaboration with the YMCA will create a ripple effect by sharing healthy eating choices with campers, their parents, and the broader community. Every other week, the Produce Box will assemble a specially chosen assortment of local, seasonal, low-prep fruits and vegetables. Campers will be able to take the food home to their families in a special bag provided by the Produce Box. Thanks to Springdale Printing, campers will also receive a newsletter with recipes and healthy tips. Also on the food train of thought, retailers donate to Anti-Hunger Group. The North Carolina Retail Merchants Association joined with Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger and House Speaker Tom Tillis to declare June Stop Summer Hunger Month in North Carolina and made a $50,000 donation to Feeding America. Retail merchants are seeing firsthand the daily needs of their customers for various types of food, paper products, hygiene, and specialty items, says North Carolina Retail Merchant Association President and General Counsel Andy Ellen. Summer is an especially difficult time for families with school-aged children who no longer have access to the free and reduced lunch program provided by the state. Hunger Facts in North Carolina. Of the 671,000 low-income children in North Carolina who receive lunch assistance during the school year, only 98,000 will be able to participate in feeding programs this summer. 80% of North Carolina households with children who receive food assistance don't know where their next meal is coming from. And 28% of food pantries in North Carolina have had to turn people away for lack of food. This week's letter to the editor includes the editor's notebook. Mr. Sugata Mukherjee is the editor of Triangle Business Journal, and this week's column is entitled, Beware of Pitfalls in Commerce Remake. Reading through the latest issue of the Southern Business and Development magazine, I saw an item about job growth and project announcements that got me thinking about whether state lawmakers are making the correct call in restructuring North Carolina's Economic Development Agency. The American South is leading all parts of the country in creating manufacturing and R&D jobs, the magazine notes, and North Carolina is right around the top in the region. The magazine notes there were 37 projects announced in the 15 southern states with a promise of 1,000 plus jobs in 2013, the highest in almost two decades. While automotive and oil and gas led the field, financial services, healthcare, and chemicals industries were right behind. Among the 15 states, North Carolina came in fourth in terms of attracting impactful projects behind Texas, Louisiana, and Tennessee. So that begs the question, are North Carolina's economic development efforts really in need of a massive overhaul? The 19-page House and Senate bill, in its latest form, privatizes the economic developmental functions and directs the new entity to raise as much as $6 million from private sources in the next 5 years to support the partnership. North Carolina will chip in $90 million for the same cause. The numbers are fluid and are changing every week. The agency will create a board to make decisions about incentives and other negotiations with prospective job creators. That board would comprise nonprofit leaders, CEOs, and other executives, and at least for now, it plans to develop a conflict of interest policy to prevent members from participating in project discussions that could result in a financial windfall for the individual or his or her company. But in recent days, language about financial disclosure of the board members was removed because the boosters of this private-public partnership, such as Commerce Secretary Sharon Decker, feared it would keep private sector executives from joining the Economic Development Board. Frankly, it's not clear, once the bill passes and the Economic Development Board is created, what role and influence Decker will have. She may be better off just quitting her cabinet job and joining the new entity. Numbers from the SB&D magazine reflects North Carolina continues to attract jobs and investment under the current economic and development policy. If we are determined to change the makeup of our conversation with companies and individuals who would create those new jobs, we'd better be sure we uphold the ethics and transparency requirements of the law. And we will be watching this transformation very closely. What follows is the guest column and is in the Triangle Business Journal this week and is entitled Four Keys to North Carolina's Prosperity. The North Carolina Association of Regional Councils worked with the North Carolina Department of Commerce and the U.S. Economic Development Administration to create a comprehensive economic development strategy for the state. The effort required 18 months of research at the regional level and included businesses, nonprofit groups, elected officials, and planning and economic development professionals. What follows are edited excerpts of the four main goals of the strategy, published as NC Tomorrow, Building Communities for Tomorrow's Jobs. Several areas of the state are globally recognized for their business and industry clusters. However, the benefits emerging from these clusters are not felt equally across the state. To achieve true prosperity, North Carolina must successfully coordinate efforts to build, grow, and maintain robust competitive areas of proficiency and innovation throughout the state. This strategy supports the continued evolution of existing clusters, and it is also aimed at supporting disruptive technologies and business models that can help North Carolina firms leapfrog global competitors. Recognized statewide targets currently include these clusters: defense and homeland security, aerospace, tourism, transportation equipment, industrial machinery, machining, electronics and instruments, financial and information services, energy, life sciences and related health informatics, and food processing and value-added agribusiness. North Carolina has many infrastructure assets on which to build, including major airports, 6 interstate highways, and broadband assets. Strategic investments must be made to ensure that these assets are maintained and expanded. North Carolina will become more competitive when businesses, entrepreneurs, and residents are able to make use of a well-coordinated and robust regional transportation, water, sewer, gas, broadband, housing, energy, and natural environment infrastructures such as national parks and forests. Providing productive workplaces with state-of-the-art broadband, the most energy-efficient buildings, and high-quality amenities will ensure that North Carolina's peoples are the most dynamic in the world. To thrive and prosper, both urban and rural communities must actively build on unique advantages to revitalize and/or maintain their city and town centers. This will require not only creating environments where businesses want to locate, but also as places where people of all ages want to spend time personally and professionally. North Carolina will need to identify main streets that offer potential as community centers, job centers, and residential centers. Targeting resources to these places is a smart investment. Despite historically high unemployment rates, many employers across the state have experienced difficulty in finding, recruiting, and hiring the kinds of skilled workers the companies need to be competitive. Companies increasingly turn to the higher education system to meet this workforce need, but not always successfully. The state has a high-quality university system, a nationally recognized community college system, and an improving and public secondary school system. These systems are becoming more demand-driven, but they have far to go. North Carolina's public workforce development and training system could lead the way, since the focus is on helping job seekers find employment. However, the system has limited resources that are spread way too thinly. The federally legislated and state-designated Workforce Development Board provides an opportunity for private sector leaders to help identify regional labor needs, guide workforce and education investments, and develop targeted training programs. Limited resources and capacity mean the boards are not always able to fulfill their role as a go-to regional workforce planning entity. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.